Welcome back to our class. Let's begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation. Then I'll set the motivation and we'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. So please make yourself comfortable in your chair, which means generally to have a straight back, have your shoulders relaxed and place your hands wherever you'd like to. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in the upper chest or lower abdomen. So you're noticing the movements in the chest or lower abdomen, and also the feelings associated with them. For each time you inhale or exhale. And whenever your mind wanders off, just try to relax a little more and place your attention once again on the movements and feelings associated with breathing. And with your attention in the here and now, bring to mind your motivation for attending the class this morning. And then with the idea that you are surrounded by all sentient beings and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present, add to the original motivation the intention to become enlightened, to bring about the welfare of every sentient being. And then we'll say the refuge prayer and generate the mind of enlightenment together. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then stabilizing this wish and enhancing it, we'll recite the prayer of the four immeasurables together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then we'll recite the seven limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And now we'll make an offering to the merit field in front of us. And the essence of this is just the letting go of the grasping that we have, the clinging to our ideas, to the body, and to our aspirations. So in the absence of the clinging, imagine a wonderful pure land appears whereby we can give teachings to others. Now this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamaratya Ami. This offering is accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and that they smile at us with delight. And dissolving into light, they melt into us. And we're put into contact with our good qualities. So I think here, you know, our intention for engaging in this material is to develop those good qualities. We're relying upon authentic spiritual teachers and their teachings, putting them into practice and realizing them, so that we can actually help others authentically and effortlessly. Okay, so thank you everyone for engaging in those preliminaries, and now we'll begin the class. So as you're aware, this is sort of the last class, and we're going to do here, we're going to just go through the questions that are one of the exams. So you'll know that there are two papers in there. One is this one we're doing, and it's got 10 questions. The other one has got, it's a sort of a, I forget what the other one's called, but it's got 6. So today we're just going to look at these first 10 questions. So today's topics will include the finding and the evaluation of a spiritual teacher, qualities that both have to have, how to relate to other traditions, and dealing with different forms of crisis that might arise. So the 10 questions sort of fit into these sort of 4 pieces of subject matter. And the books I've drawn the answers from are these ones here. So a lot of it's been coming from The Foundation of Buddhist Practice, a book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron. And another book by Geshe Sopa here called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. So here's a quote from Geshe Potowa. Geshe Potowa was a wonderful exponent of the Buddhist teachings, especially thought transformation. So he says here, "In order to obtain liberation, there is nothing more important than the teacher. Although you may be able to do the activities of this life by watching others, without a teacher, you will not do them well. So how can someone who has just arrived from the bad migrations get to a place they've never been without a guide?" So I particularly like that last sentence, how can someone who has just arrived from the bad migrations get to a place they've never been without a guide? And it makes me think of the, you know, all around the world at the moment we have large migratory forces, people fleeing from troubles and becoming, you know, refugees. And they certainly need guides to move from one country to another. And then when they find like a refuge, you know, what to do there, how to put the refuge into practice. So we see this in the ordinary world today. We could also relate it to ourselves by thinking, you know, we've finally found ourselves as human beings with a leisure and opportunity to engage in spiritual practice. But we need someone to help us. So books are useful. But yeah, you know, like it's very good to also have a living person to talk about what we've discovered and how to put it into practice.
So Eddie, that analogy is so good too, because it's like, you know, if you're newly arrived in a country, you're really disoriented and you don't know how to take advantage of the services that are on offer and you really need support. And that's just like we are, we're refugees in a perfect human rebirth, but kind of unaware of how to really take the best advantage of it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, Michi. Yeah. So I'll just read you a little bit from Holiness the Dalai Lama from the book The Foundation of Buddhist Practice. And this is coming on page 77, where he says, "The Dharma is the key to having a meaningful and happy life now and in the future. To practice it seriously, two conditions must be present. The external condition is relying on the guidance of a qualified spiritual mentor. And the internal condition is a precious human life with the freedom and fortune to practice the Dharma." So for most of us, we've got the first part. We find ourselves as human beings. We have freedom. We're lucky enough to be able to, you know, find the teachings. We know they're here. We want to put them into practice. Some of us may not have found yet a human guide that we can place our faith in. So as Holiness goes on to say, when we are seriously interested in following the path, forming a healthy relationship with a qualified spiritual teacher is essential. If we need teachers for ordinary skills, such as driving or typing, we certainly need them for more complex and delicate endeavors, such as transforming our mind into that of a Buddha. And Lama Tsongkhapa from Lamrim Chenpo says, "Thus the excellent teacher is the source of all temporary happiness and highest goodness. Beginning with the production of a single good quality and the reduction of a single fault in a student's mind, and eventually encompassing all the knowledge beyond that. The spiritual teachers play a unique and important role in our lives. Qualified spiritual mentors guide us along the path by giving us teachings, Dharma advice, precepts, oral transmissions, and empowerments. And when we experience blocks in our practice, then they can teach us the antidotes to overcome them. When we have spiritual experiences, they help us determine if the experiences were authentic or deceptive. And when our practice is going well, then our mentors will encourage us to continue with the practice. There's a, you know, a reasoning that we can call upon and remember in relationship to, you know, this idea of, do I actually need a teacher? So take ourselves, a person who wishes to become omniscient. So omniscience is another term for Buddha, fully awakened being. So I'm a person who wishes to fully awake. Then I need to have a spiritual friend and follow their advice. Like, why? What's the reason? And the reason is I do not know how to gather the two accumulations, and I don't know how to purify the two obscurations. So I need help in doing both of those things. Now, for some of us, it might be like we don't even know what the two accumulations are or what the two obscurations are. So the two accumulations are the sort of the means to achieve omniscience, but we've got these two things that block it, and they're called these two obscurations. So we need to know how to remove those two obscurations and engage in a path whereby we can use these two accumulations to achieve the two bodies of Buddhahood. So finding a spiritual friend. So as you're probably aware, if you might remember, there was these four steps in there. So one of the first things we can do is try to examine the lineage. So when we meet teachers, we sort of like, we want to know what's their background, where do they come from, whose teachings are they following, are they within a tradition, is there a lineage there? If there is, what is it? Now, the lineage itself cannot guarantee a teacher's trustworthiness. Yet, it is one of the things we need to consider. And this is specifically meant to be like as a guideline, not a guarantee. So the lineage provides sort of an excellent place to start. I've noticed myself when, like, for instance, when we've had new teachers come, they will tell you a bit about their background. I particularly remember with, who's the present teacher now? If you have
a, Geshe Zopa. Geshe Zopa.
No, the teacher up at, well, Geshe's, no, I'm talking about the teacher at Chenrezig Institute.
Geshe Saltram.
Right, so I remember we first going there and listening to him, and then he gave this big background story of who his master was, the college he came from, and stuff about his life.
And it's also, actually, Eddie, it kind of shows that if whoever we're taking teachings from, if they speak about their master, their guru, specifically, you know, with that warmth of like real devotion, then that's a really good sign. And a couple of times when we've had people come and speak and they've just, say, for instance, just been authors, not necessarily teachers in a lineage, and then when someone has asked who are your teachers, they've just had this big long list of people, but no one who they treat as their master or their guru that they follow.
Yeah, it's often you notice the difference, isn't it? Most there can be times when their attention is really focused on them, and then other times when they're much more humble and their attention is placed upon their teacher and the lineage. So that's what you're sort of looking for, you know, that they have a lineage and that they emphasize it. So every one time, the first time I took a higher Shaga Tantra initiation from Kensa Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Sering, and he started off by saying to us that this teaching was given to him by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And it was given to His Holiness the Dalai Lama by Trajang Rinpoche. And Trajang Rinpoche got it from Pabongka Rinpoche. And then he just started going backwards. He said, this comes from the Buddha. It was like this, you know, you're sort of sitting there going, oh, my God, like, I'm part of this. Now I am part of the lineage. So it gives you a sort of sense of humility, but also a sense of belonging. That, yeah, you're part of something. There's something that goes back. It's not just new and come into the room. So, you know, it's a good idea then to, if we're thinking of adopting a person to be our, you know, formally as our teacher, as a guru, then we need to go through these stages. Of course, if we were really new to the teachings, we wouldn't need to do that. You know, we just take the teachings as like somebody helpful, really friendly, trying to help us deal with the problems we've got. If we want to go deeper, like I said, then we need to engage a bit more deeply into the analysis. So begin by examining the lineage, and then try and find, you know, the history of their practice. So authentic teachers will tell you about that. So I remember one of the things Kensa Rinpoche said, he said, you know, like, I don't have any realizations of this, blah, 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 all humble. But then he said, but what I can tell you is that I have kept my vows. So that gives you a thought, whoa, that, you know, that's a big deal to me. So we need to know something about the practices that they've engaged in. I also remember times when some of the students have asked Geshe, like, do you have the realization of equanimity, for instance? So when we give teachings on the six causes and one effect, you talk about the history of it, and then he'd talk about, you know, how wonderful it would be if we could even just have equanimity. We needed to have it to develop the good qualities of love and kindness and compassion. And then somebody would say, "Do you have equanimity, Geshe-la?" And he would just sort of laugh and joke and go, "No, no, not me."
Though, Eddie, this sometimes can backfire because Westerners really need to have the qualities of the teacher sung to them in order to have confidence. And culturally, you know, from the Tibetan lineage, you downplay everything. And so there is a little bit of a cultural hiccup that happens with that, where somebody actually needs to sing the praises of the teacher.
Well, it won't be, you know,
because otherwise people go, "Well, gee whiz, if Geshe Tashi Sering says he doesn't have any realizations, then what hope is there for me?"
Well, then that's where we need to be paying attention and going, he says this, but he actually demonstrates equanimity.
Okay.
You know, so don't, when it comes to, you know, we should understand that the teachers will never sing their praises, or very, very, very rarely. And if they did, it wouldn't be in like a public space. It might be just if you were sitting there and they're there and they started talking a little bit about their practice to sort of inspire you. But I'd be very surprised if any of them ever did it in a public space. Tell you about, you know, what their realizations were and how long
they wouldn't say their realizations, but they do say their background, like the facts, where they've studied, and you know, give us confidence.
Yeah, and you know, thirdly, we need to know that they'll actually take care of us, that they actually are concerned about us, and they will care for us. And lastly, that they maintain their vows. So you might not know what those vows are, but as you study a bit more, you'll find out. You'll see, oh, there are these refuge vows. There are the vows of the bodhisattvas, the aspirational vows and the engaging vows. And then later on, there are tantric vows. And you'd be able to tell many ways that they are maintaining those vows. And that's what so impressed me when Geshe said, you know, like, I don't have any realizations, but I can tell you this, I've done that, I've kept my vows. And if you've read of the vows, you just go, that's a big deal. Now, when we a founder teacher, they're going to often be quite skilled, and they need to be, because they're teaching to all sorts of people, and these people are all at different levels of understanding and learning. So you need people that can go from sort of the high to the low. So one time I was at a teaching by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Miffy was there also, and our friends Jordan and Pearlie were there. And it was a teaching on bodhicitta. And the teaching came from a text by Nagarjuna. And you know, so he went in and listened, and in this lesson, I did not know what His Holiness was talking about. I just got, man, I got no idea what he's talking about. So, you know, this was like in good English. It all came across quite clearly. But it was just like this thing going, oh, my God, like how deep these teachings are. On one level, it's all understandable. And yep, 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 you can say that. Then they just up it and you go, I'm lost. So there are different qualities that they have. And, of course, this has to do for the different levels and types of study and practice there are. And we need people that can shift from explaining it very simply to going to great depth and detail. So here is Holiness the Dalai Lama says, the reason behind the necessity for different qualities in the master that accord with the different types of study and practice is simply that the nature of any specific level of training demands a specific guru-disciple relationship. So in brief, you can divide up all these trainings into what they call the teachings of the foundation vehicle and teachings of the bodhisattvas, and then teachings of tantra. And so we're really fortunate that we have these great teachers that come out of the teaching institutions of India that go from the top to the bottom all the way. And I think Australia's got more Larumpa Geshis, meaning Geshis with the highest degree that you can possibly have, in Australia at the moment. This has been this way for some time. So we're really, very fortunate that this is the way it is. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, I recommend going about the stages of practice in a gradual way. First, form a relationship with a fundamental vehicle teacher. Learn the four truths and take refuge in some level of liberation precepts. Later, as your practice progresses, seek out a spiritual mentor who can teach you the bodhisattva path. Practice the six perfections and undertake the bodhisattva ethical restraints. After some time, when you are properly prepared, seek a qualified tantric master. Receive empowerment into that practice and then meditate on deity yoga. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask so far?
So let's see, Alison's just said about she gets the cultural, hiccup, the discrepancy between singing your praises that we do and the Tibetan way, but she prefers the Tibetan way because, like you said, we can see for ourselves and check up.
Yeah, okay, that's good, Alison. You want to ask anything to offer or would like the question? Or move on to some of these.
Eddie, where in that quote where it says to the specific, on the specific level that His Holiness said that we need a teacher, what's the significance of saying that?
Are you talking here like this? I need a bit more information, I think, Mifi. In terms of fundamental vehicle teacher, then next and next.
Well, in the quote, it said you need a teacher on the specific level for this, a specific teacher. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the student can not be lost. They can maintain confidence in the teachings. Because so there's been a couple of times that I've been at teachings where one, like I said, like I'd sit there and go, I don't know what they're talking about. And then another time I remember, especially we went to the Blue Mountains to have a Yamantaka initiation. And then, we were to take that initiation, we were required to sort of know a certain amount of material before you went there. And then when we were there, it transpired that there was a lot of people there that didn't have that background. So then the teaching wasn't given. So it shows you that students need to meet teachers who can explain things at a level of comprehension. And then the student can take that and then move through. If that's not in place, then to give a student teachings that don't fit them, that's not useful.
Right. So so we really need to do the preparation so that we have the merit and also the background to get that teaching. Anne also says, just thank you regarding, say, your comment about Nagarjuna's teaching, because she now understands why she was following along nicely and then got lost so quickly.
Yes, it's not unusual with teachings by Nagarjuna and yeah. Okay, I'll move on then, and we'll have a look now at some of the different types of teacher that will take us through these different levels. Okay, so the first one is what we call the preceptor. So when you first come along to the classes and the teachings, you'll have somebody, a teacher there giving teachings. And over a period of time, what will often happen is the first set of vows will be given, which are often refuge vows. So these are called the vows of individual liberation. So in other words, to put an end to your own suffering, to bring about a liberation that applies to you, you can take refuge. And this is given by the refuge preceptor. Now, the refuge preceptor, especially in our traditions, and the ones that have come out of India, for instance, with all the great training, they could give the precepts of individual liberation, the precepts of the bodhisattva ordination, and also the tantric initiations. So we can have people who can do all three levels of precepts. And when this person gives this vow or imparts the vow, then they are representatives of the Buddha. And you'll often see that Miffy's often made a little small altar in front of them with offerings of flowers and oftentimes a small bowl of food. And this person is standing in for the Buddha, right, to give each one of us the vow of becoming a Buddhist, a refugee from samsara. You see, they give us the vow of refuge. So when we have learned enough and think that this really suits us, this way of learning, this way of teaching, the philosophy, the ideals, it sits right with us. We might decide then, I wish to become a Buddhist. I wish to take a refuge in this way of life. And then we, so when that happens, then I think that we have it often once a year, wasn't it, Mufi? We would have a refuge ceremony here, or we'd have there'd be one up at Chen Rinzik Institute.
Yeah, that's right. And so the refuge ceremony is usually held by the resident Geshe from Chen Rinzik Institute. But even then, each Geshe has led the ceremony in a slightly different way. But all have said that they're an emissary or a representative of the Buddha on our behalf, and that actually what we're taking refuge in is the Buddha.
Yeah, what we're taking refuge in is the three jewels: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Well, Lama's open the three rare and precious ones. That is our refuge.
Three rare sublime ones.
It's not the person, and it's not the tradition they're coming out of. We're taking refuge in the three rare sublime ones, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, so this is a quote by Alexander Berzin from Relating to a Spiritual Teacher. He says, in the context of Tibetan Buddhism, refuge or vow preceptors are necessarily Mahayana elders. Moreover, they need to be spiritual mentors who have kept their vows purely for a certain number of years on the level of vow conferred. And this qualification adds a gravity and authenticity to the event, as preceptors formally link their progeny, meaning us, to the traditions, tracing back to the immediate disciples of the historical Buddha.
So that's got actually two things in there. There's the lineage, but there's also that we're getting a clean set of vows, like a strong set of vows from the preceptor.
Yeah, and so it goes all the way back to the Buddha, and that this person has actually kept their vow, the refuge vow. And you'll often see that when they give this vow, they often will talk The teaching will be based around the Four Noble Truths. You know, and then they talk about suffering and how we want to put an end to it and how we can put an end to it. And this is the teaching of the Buddha. And that if we want to do this, you know, we can take these precepts. And then they offer us a number of precepts. But you know, the first one, of course, is just the refuge precept, to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Then often they will offer another type of five precepts as well. We've entered the path of the Buddha. We've taken refuge in the three jewels. So we know how to look after ourselves. We engage in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. We know we can put an end to our suffering. And we might think, what about everyone else? So we can be now introduced to the Mahayana master and the Bodhisattva vow. So like I said, it's the level of the Mahayana. And now we see the person not just being like a representative of the Buddha, but we to approach them as to be just like a Buddha. So just as taking safe direction is the gateway to entering the Buddhist path in general, developing the bodhicitta motivation is the entrance to the Mahayana. And furthermore, bodhicitta has two stages. The mere development of the motivation constitutes aspiring bodhicitta, the aspiration to become a Buddha to benefit others as much as is possible. And so there are vows of aspirational bodhicitta that I remember at different times His Holiness has just offered that type of vow. Other times He's offered the vow that follows on called the engaging bodhisattva vows. So with engaged bodhicitta, disciples commit themselves with bodhisattva vows to train intensively in the methods and wisdom that bring enlightenment and to help others now, you know, as much as they can. His Holiness goes on to say that perfection vehicle texts speak of Buddhas and bodhisattvas emanating in many forms to benefit others. Since our perfection vehicle teacher leads us on the bodhisattva path and gives us the bodhisattva ethical restraints, we view that person as an emanation of the Buddha or as a high bodhisattva. Here, the teacher is seen as equal to or like a Buddha, in the sense that the karma accumulated in relation to our teacher is like that accumulated in relation to the Buddha. So by making offerings to or harming our perfection vehicle teacher, we accumulate karma equal to acting in a similar way towards the Buddha himself.
See, that's pretty amazing. And I don't know if I missed that during the course, but that's a whole different take on why to see the Lama as being like the Buddha or being a Bodhisattva. That's just amazing. It's for our own merit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is why oftentimes, you know, when we take, you know, one of the things we're meant to do, I'm sure most of us forget, that when we take teachings from our teacher, if we have this, like, so taken this, if we've taken this bodhisattva vow, like when we walk in there to take it, we should think of ourselves as being bodhisattvas, and you know, we're in this lovely, and we're in a like a special pure land, taking teachings from our teacher who is just like the Buddha himself. In fact, is an emanation of the Buddha. Now we sit there and the ground should be blue and soft and have gold lines running across it, and the cushion we're sitting on should be really soft, and we don't see ourselves as sitting there as ordinary people. We are bodhisattvas in training. So that's what we should be doing, but we probably either don't know or if we often forget to do that.
So Anne says, so it seems like the bodhisattva vow is really like a special gift from the teacher to us.
Oh, yeah, it's a big deal. Yeah, and let's say there's a part of it where they say, you know, you should really rejoice when you take this vow. There's an extra section in there, isn't there, that requires us to rejoice for receiving. Yes. It's like this gift.
And you kind of notice that in the ceremony, when it comes to that part where we've received the vow and everybody's then supposed to really, really rejoice, that's the exact time when the Lama will crack a joke so that everybody just spontaneously laughs.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, so the Bodhisattva vow, you take that vow, you have that vow till you become awakened. Whereas the refuge vow just lasts you from one life to another. So just by the time we die in this life, refuge vow is finished. Well, if we've taken the Bodhisattva vow, it goes on. So yeah, it's a big gift. The next master we can look at is what we call the Tantric master. So of course, this is at the level of the Vajrayana. So the Mahayana disciples may travel the path to enlightenment through the methods of either sutra or tantra. So the sutras contain Buddha's basic teachings on the methods for gaining the positive qualities. And this is like the foundation. So we have trained in those, in the fundamental vehicle and the perfection vehicle practices, and are sort of sufficiently mature, then we might request empowerment into practices of various tantric meditational deities. So when that takes place, students have to imagine the guru giving the empowerment to be the meditational deity and the environment to be the deity's abode or mandala. And when doing tantric practice following empowerment, we imagine ourselves and all sentient beings as Buddhas, and the environment is a pure land. So in this case, not seeing our tantric master as a Buddha would be quite strange. We see them as the Buddha. The master here, gives us the vows and the pledges of the tantric vehicle. It's only in tantric practice is it essential to regard the tantric master as a Buddha. His Holiness goes on to say that this view should not be taught to beginners who are not mature in the Dharma, because it is open to misinterpretation and confusion. And this is what has happened to a lot of our people in the West, especially not so much in our tradition, but in the Nyingma and Kagyu traditions.
Eddie, there's a couple of comments. So I was just thinking, one is that even during the initiation ceremony, when it's being conferred, whoever the translator is always very careful not to say, oh, and Geshe-la says this and Geshe-la says that, but always says, the Vajra master says this or the Vajra master says that, just so that our vision doesn't focus on the ordinary.
Yeah, that's right.
Helene also says that she remembers when Puntsog Rinpoche came with Geshe Zopa. So Puntsog Rinpoche was 13 years old and when he visited Lungri Tampa Center, and said, oh, wow, there were so many bodhisattvas in this room. And all of us students just looked at each other around like, who, me, us?
Yeah. Okay, so now just another slide on these. So you can see there's different levels of qualities in the teachers, but also different ways of us apprehending them. So this leads to the next slide. We talk about these levels of training again. So you can see our progress goes through these different stages, the first becoming a refugee, then taking on the Bodhisattva precepts, and then finally moving through to become a practitioner of Tantra. So there's all different, it's like foundation stages and transformational stages, and finally the stage of Tantra. The relationship and the role between us and the teacher will also differ. As you can see, the teacher is a Buddha, the teacher is a representation of the Buddha, an emanation of the Buddha and the representation. So once again, there's differences in the way we relate to one another. And of course, in terms of the different training, then accomplishment stepper. So this is basically for all of us. All of us as seekers will progress through stages along the path. And most students will study with different teachers during their lifetimes and build up different relationships with each of them. And not every one of our teachers will have reached the same level of accomplishment. And usually what happens is that we as the students will relate to our teachers differently as our progression becomes deeper. And oftentimes you'll see that the teacher will relate to you as a student as they can see you're taking on more responsibility and becoming more serious in your practice. Now, this is from the Ornament of the Mahayana Sutras by Arya Maitreya. He says, look, this teacher that we're going to rely upon should have these sort of qualities. And in fact, there's 10 of them given here. So it says, rely on a spiritual guide who is disciplined, serene, thoroughly pacified. These are three higher trainings. Who has more qualities than you. Perseverance, a wealth of scripture. Realization into suchness. Who is a skilled speaker, has love, and has abandoned disappointment in the disciple's performance. Now, these 10 qualities can be abbreviated into 3. So you need a teacher who is should be learned and wise, disciplined, and have a kind heart. Isn't that nice? A kind heart, to be disciplined, and to be learned and wise. As Holiness goes on to say, the discipline of the teacher should not prevent learnedness, and their learnedness should not lead to the neglect of discipline. And even if he has both learning and discipline, if he lacks a kind heart, he will not be able to help others on a vast scale. If he has a kind heart but lacks learning and discipline, he will also likewise be unable to lead others on the path. Thus, all three qualities are necessary. Now, although finding teachers with all 10 qualities fully developed may be difficult, try to find teachers with as many of those qualities as possible. Follow teachers who have at least more good qualities than negative ones, who are more interested in future lives than in this life, and consider others more important than themselves. That's a lovely way of sort of summing up these 10 into different groups of 3.
Can you just read that last one again? That's really nice.
He says, follow teachers who have at least more good qualities than negative ones, are more interested in future lives than in this life, and consider others more important than themselves.
So that kind of points out that even if they don't have a huge amount of scriptural knowledge, just being with someone like that is going to have a good effect on us.
Yes. Yeah, so it may be that we can have, like I know, for instance, for certainty, is, you know, like I said before, there's different the different levels of knowledge being a geshe. Like, you know, the highest is a larumpa geshe. Then below that's one other type. And there's another type. So, it's, you know, degrees of being a geshe. If you're a larumpa, of course, you are the most learned and so forth. But like I said, you know, a person could have that but not have a great deal of warmth. Right? So that doesn't really help a great deal. Whereas I know of another one who's got a great deal of warmth, not as learned as the Larenpa Geshes, but it's made a massive impact on the students that, that surround him and the harmony of the centre that he lives at.
And that that warmth comes from actually practising the good heart, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So it's there are these 10 qualities, and you should try and memorize these. You know, so, you know, like I put up that slide before, we're not having it today, but it's like a review, but it goes disciplined, serene, thoroughly pacified. They're the first three, and they're they are related to the three higher trainings. So disciplined, serene, thoroughly pacified. And then the first three qualities of the teacher, the next three, as a, you know, they have to know more than us. They should have a vast knowledge of scripture and a thorough knowledge of reality. So, you know, there's three there. You can see a progression there. And so they're the six major qualities that the teacher has for themselves. And then they need four other qualities to really help the student. So they need to be very skilled to have abandoned dispiritedness, meaning, you know, the students sometimes takes a lot of time to learn something, and they come and, you know, we forget things over and over, and the teacher's got to do it again and again.
We don't do our homework.
Yeah, we don't do our homework. We're all scared of doing tests and exams, you know. The intention to be a teacher, the motivation has to be one of love, has to be one of kindness. If your teacher's not kind, I would suggest it's going to be very difficult to have students to follow him. So the motivation has to be one of kindness, and then they have to be sort of enthusiastic about what they're doing. So there are your 10. You know, so it's easy if you just break up into three lots. The first of the three higher trainings, and the next three about, you know, the learning capacities of the teacher, know more than us, know a lot about all the scriptures and the teachings and so forth, and have a good knowledge, a thorough comprehension of emptiness as it's presented in the Middle Way Consequence School. And then these last four, which is for me an acronym, SAIL: skilled, abandoned dispiritedness, loving kindness, and enthusiasm. So it's not hard to pull, you know, those together. Now we need to check that they have these qualities. And like you said before, you know, we can put it into a couple of other groups of three. More good qualities than negative ones, more interested in future lives, and consider others as more important than themselves, is another lovely way of looking at it. So we need to check.
Eddie, can you just stop the screen share for a moment? There's a question here from Anne. So about just the term guru that has been a difficult term for her because of the, in the West, you know, it's got pretty bad connotations. It's been misused and exploited. So, you know, she's confident that she'll get to a point in her study when she feels at ease with this term, but in the meantime, is it okay to use the term teacher? Or, like, how do we actually...
Especially teacher, especially when you haven't actually taken one on formally. You know, the way to look at them is that it's like friend, teacher. I've heard Venerable Seren just call them Genla. So Gen is like teacher.
So teacher has the term of respect, and it also helps our mind. And then, but if we have taken vows, then of course they're a guru of sorts, you know, even if we've just, it's, well, just even if it's purely the refuge vows, then they become our guru and our preceptor.
So the word guru, Anne, you've got to get your head around, which it was just the same with me. I had the same problem until I read, you know, the book that will really help you here is Alexander Berzin's book. So when you read the meaning of guru there, it's tremendous. So like I said, guru just means heavy, heavy. Like, why is he heavy? He's heavy because he's got all his good qualities. So that's the meaning of it, gu and ru, heavy with good qualities. And how do we know this? It's because we had a look. We had to look for these 10 qualities, or else we, did it this other way, the two groups of three, or it was five. And you go, okay. But after that, remember, there's a whole thing of going like as friend. So if they give you, like, you take vows, then you go, the qualities that they have the qualities to be able to give us that vow. Yeah, and the other term they often use, and is like lama, which is also very nice, because one of the word la means mother. And so a mother is someone who's given birth to a child. But here, the lama, what have they given birth to? The mind of enlightenment. And then we become their children when they give us the vows. So, like I said, Alexander Berzin's book's the very best book I've read that breaks this down. And believe me, the meaning of guru is immense and deep. And you can you'll infer a lot of good stuff from it, Anne, if you have a look at that. Okay, shall I go on? Back to our slides?
Yep, please do.
Okay, so are you guys back? Are you on a slide now or not?
No. You've got to go to screen share.
Yeah, that would be good if I could do that.
So where you have your little picture of you talking or?
Yeah.
Okay, so down the bottom right of that picture is a little green arrow.
Yes.
So click that. It'll make the whole thing come up. Now go to screen share.
Okay.
Good-o.
You're back?
Yep.
Okay. So he says, although we are the ones who choose our spiritual mentors, there are certain conditions under which someone becomes one of our teachers. For example, if they give us refuge and the five precepts, they're our teacher now. If they give us monastic ordination or the bodhisattva ethical restraints or the tantric initiation, we now have a formal relationship with them. So it's for this reason it's so necessary that we check the person's qualifications before attending those ceremonies and not rush blindly into things. This is the qualities of a spiritual teacher are described at such great length in the text so that we will know what to look for when seeking a guru capable of opening the Buddhist paths within us. And the Tibetans say, when you meet a teacher, don't devour that person like a dog that gulps down meat without tasting it first. Investigate. Examine. This is the student's responsibility. And this is from Mingo Rinpoche from a book called Turn Confusion into Clarity.
Especially is like... Yeah. Dogs have perfect guru devotion. It's just a really, it's an analogy that just keeps on giving.
Yeah, we just have to feed them. They just gulp it down. Anyone who feeds a dog likes. So this is the last one from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He says, I recommend that people attend Dharma teachings and get to know the person first. At this time, do not regard them as him or her as your teacher, let alone as a Buddha. Consider the person as a Dharma friend who shares information with you. Observe his or her conduct in daily life and assess their understanding of the teachings as best you can. Then ask other students about the teacher's qualities and look at the qualities of those students to see if you want to become like them by following the same teacher. Check if the teacher has a good relationship with his or her teachers. In addition, read Dharma books so that you have a general knowledge of Buddhist tenets and can assess if this person's teachings are correct. Okay, let's go on. I better move it. So, yeah, we've come across our Dharma teachers and we're going to come across other traditions, or we've left other traditions, and you'll notice there's some big differences in them. But there are also great similarities. So in many of the creative religions, they talk about God, a God that creates everything. In Buddhism, we have the Dharmakaya, that's the creator, the creative principle. So we've got to know, like, what is this Dharmakaya? So kaya means body, and Dharma is like all phenomena. The body, and the Dharma also means to hold. So, you know, the body that holds all phenomena. What do you think that might be? So the answer is, of course, a mind that is fully awake, fully enlightened. So that's, in a way, a bit like God. There's differences, of course, but you can look at it and go, yeah, no problem. I don't have any problem with this idea of God. So I also recommend get your head around dependent arising as much as you can, and you'll end up relaxing a great deal. Is there one saviour or many? Now, in our tradition, we have many Buddhas, many bodhisattvas. In Christianity, there's Jesus, one saviour, one God. Yeah, and in other traditions, it's a bit like that too. Is there this thing called a one soul, or there are, or many rebirths, one life or karma? So you'll know that there are major differences within the religions and so forth. But like I said, understand that, you know, where we all meet is in the methodology. The philosophy is very different. Only Buddhism has emptiness united with dependent arising. Every other religion has some sort of aspect of inherent existence. But all the methods are about loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness, faith, all those good qualities. There are plenty of meeting places there. So we can always, you know, just relate to them on that level and leave the philosophy alone. So, you know, we just differ on the philosophy. So nevertheless, we should respect the other religions. Like I said, they're all trying to put an end to suffering in their own way. So that leads us to our qualities, right? So be non-biased about this stuff. Be open-minded about it. That means using your intelligence. This is one of the best ways for intelligence here is the intelligence that understands dependent arising. Something exists because something else does. There isn't anything that exists independently of everything. And be diligent in what you study and how you behave. So these are the three major ones. And Chandrakirti added two others, respect and attentiveness.
Eddie, I think the standout thing for me about the qualities of a disciple is that we have this kind of emotional neediness to just want to give all the responsibility to the teacher, and actually we can't ever do that. We've got to have the responsibility ourselves, so that qualities of the disciple really points that out.
Yeah, this is not like... I remember this, in the first verse of The Foundation of All Good Qualities, it says, the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. And then it goes on to say, correct devotion to him is the root of the path. But Kensa Rinpoche went, do not take that literally. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. He said, the foundation is the relationship you establish with the teacher and the teachings.
Right, so the actual correct devotion part is the foundation.
the relationship is the foundation. From the relationship, you can have a correct devotion. But the devotion will come only after you've investigated this person.
Right.
So problems can arise in the relationship, just like ordinary relationships. So a couple of things you could ask. You know? First of all, is what's going on here against the law, like against the law of the land? If it is, you don't want to break the law. So you need to know, is this against the law of the land or not? Check up. Is it contrary to the Dharma or your vows? Once again, there are a number of different books with all the vows in it. There are explanations of them. If you're uncertain, hit the stacks. And then what if it's a small negativity? So once again, you need to sort of, you know, there aren't any negativities that can't be purified. But it's like, you know, saying, you know, having your foot broken is a small break compared to having your back broken. But do you actually want to have your foot broken? It's all got to be repaired. Benefit doesn't need to be. You know, so you can also check there.
Also, Eddie, I think sometimes historically there's a bit of a double standard has developed, like for this one of is it against the law? So, you know, there was one example I remember of a centre. They wanted to put a stupa in the garden of the centre. And so some people wanted to check up, you know, with the council regulations, and others just went, oh, look, it's a holy object, let's just do it. And so, of course, the Lama said, just do it. Then they got into really big trouble because it wasn't up to code, and they ended up actually having to move from that centre. So, you know, on those kind of levels where it's clearly a cultural thing, and from a Dharma point of view, it might be brilliant, but actually from the laws of the land, it's you know, the worldly point of view, it's not going to work. But also they're on a more kind of personal level, there's been a double standard where bad behaviour from a Tibetan is acceptable, whereas, say, if it was from a Westerner, workplace health and safety and workplace bullying would be all over it. But somehow there's even historically, for instance, the Geshis didn't always have to sign the privacy agreement or the conduct agreement that we have in the FPMT, but everybody has to sign it. Geshis, monks, nuns, Westerners, and to be held to the same standard. But I know Westerners don't hold, you know, have this double standard with Tibetans and think, oh, it's culturally different. But actually, when we're in the West, then you have to abide by our Western standards.
Yeah.
And to not feel bad about expecting that.
Well, you might feel bad, but you've got to go on anyway. You know, like challenge it.
Yeah, challenge it. And because what we're challenging isn't the Buddhist teachings of the guru, what we're challenging is the abiding by the law. So it's quite it's a containable thing. We just have to keep it in that context.
Yeah. Yeah. So we need to check up. And if we find that it is contrary to the Dharma, is contrary to the law, and that even though it's a small negativity, we don't want to engage in it, then we need to discuss the situation in an open and reasonable manner. Then politely explain why you are unable to comply with the instruction. And then excuse yourself with soothing words. So Geshe Sofa says, you know, even when you have good reasons for not following certain instructions, that's not a reason to be disrespectful or to despise the teacher or to slander them. So don't let, you know, is reasons and cause your attitude to turn negative.
And Eddie, this is also another one where we can learn so much and change our behaviour, because also often in the West, we let things slide until we kind of explode. And then when we discuss the situation, it's not open and reasonable. We needed all of that kind of impetus behind us to even say anything, because it's been all bottled up, that it comes out in this really aggressive way. So to have the incentive to deal with it much earlier and with a lot more confidence.
Yeah, that's right. So, so sometimes we, like you say, so we have this difficulty, for instance, and there are different ways of dealing with the difficulties. So like I said, so sometimes it's like you have this polite discussion with them, you try to get it explained and so forth. Along with that, you can have this idea of like, what has actually been, what are they teaching me here? So even there, the behavior could be like negative or against. So they engage in activity, behavior that's, you know, is against the law. So what's he teaching you? I would suggest don't do what he's doing. Don't go and act against the law. There's these huge consequences. So he's teaching you that. And as Holiness says, he's not teaching you to go along with him and break the law. That's not what the lesson is. So it's again, what can I learn from this?
So I mean, the biggest thing that we can learn from this is to separate out the worldly qualities of the guru and the actual real amazing qualities of teaching the Dharma, and to, you know, not mix up those levels.
Yeah, so you can easily say, hey, you know, my teacher doesn't know about the law of the land or the consequences of having that law broken. I need to explain to him why I can't go along with this and what some of the problems will be if we go along with it. So, and that's fine, but that's what we call, you know, the stuff, the law of the land. It's not Dharma. You know, my teacher knows a heck of a lot more about Dharma than I could ever do. I'm not disputing that. I'm disputing this other thing. You know, it might be like if you told me a story about, you know, driving in a car with Lama Yeshe, where you get just so scared. It's just like, oh, well, no thanks.
Or driving in a car with Venerable Ravina.
Yeah.
Who said that the place she loves driving the best out of the whole world was driving in Russia, because it's like a combination of Indian driving really, really fast with no road rules, and you could just, so of course that's her modus operandi, and you get arrested immediately driving like that in Australia.
Yeah. So like, you know, so like I, the thing is, in, so suppose you're a passenger in the car, you know, so then it's like, so what is he teaching me? What's happening to me? What can I learn about myself from this? So one of the things I'd suggest you'd learn is you certainly quickly identify the object to be negated. A sense of I will arise very strongly.
Am I ready to die yet?
Yeah, that's what Lama Yeshe was saying, eh? Are you ready to die?
You'd be just driving at a million miles an hour, like up and down the roads at Chinresic Institute, at the same speed, whether it's going up, down, or turning a corner on those incredibly rocky roads, absolutely laughing his head off and turning to the person, all the people in the car that are holding on white-knuckled, going, are you ready to die? Are you ready to die?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure you'd learn something there. But suppose there's no resolving of the problem. Right, well then, you are, as Holiness says, keep your distance. So he says, if you have taken someone as your spiritual mentor and discover he's engaged in some questionable behavior, you may stop attending his teachings. But avoid disrespect or antipathy. Anger will only make you miserable. The Kala Chakra Tantra advises maintaining a neutral attitude and not pursuing the relationship any further. Keep your distance and cultivate relationships with other newer teachers, but do not angrily denounce your previous teacher. They benefited you in the past, and it is appropriate to acknowledge and appreciate that, even though you don't follow them now. So keep your distance, avoid anger, become neutral, but also acknowledge benefit. So we've come to the end of our class, and what we basically did, funny, I called find a new teacher. We looked at these 10 public exam questions, and I've done my best to provide answers for you. So go over those if you like. So you know there's two sets of questions there. There's the public examination one, or there's the assessment ones. And do your best to answer either one of those examinations. In terms of trying to remember things, try and cultivate an outline of this topic. You know, like the first topic is like, why do I need a teacher? If I have a teacher, what sort of qualities should they have? And what sort of qualities should I have? And then how do I relate to them? And if there's problems that arise, what do I do? So this is sort of like an outline.
They're all really, really good checklists. I mean, and they're good checklists for any form of teacher. I mean, especially a Dharma teacher, but when you're trying to find a driving instructor or a cooking teacher or a crochet teacher or anything.
Yep. Anyway, I encourage you to do this. Otherwise, you know, what will happen is you'll meet teachers that you feel drawn to on the heart level. You'll feel emotionally drawn to them. And this, you won't even draw on any of this. So it's good to complement the heart with reason, and it's good to complement reason with the heart. Emotion and the heart, emotion and reason should work together, not separately. And you certainly want to bring them together in something as important as this topic. So I wish you luck in doing that. And
does anyone
just
want to
say thank you for coming along with these lessons.
Any other, hang on a second. Does anyone have
any final questions?
Yeah, so Anne was just saying that she was thinking also those points on what if problems can't be resolved. They're quite mm-hmm. similar to our kind of standard conflict resolution kind okay. of strategies that we have in the West. And they're also, I mean, they're very similar also to do with just basic business principles. So this is a universally recognized strategy to have to focus on the benefits that we have got and to have a healthy, neutral kind of backing off. And that for the long term, that is far more beneficial than kind of screaming from the rooftops.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to dedicate now then. So,
So there is one more. So, Anne also asked, is it okay that she hasn't been able to do all the readings yet?
Well, do the best you can, Anne. The topic will come back up again.
And they're probably just very good to go back to and refer back to as the topic comes up again.
Yeah. And so this is one of the things I was suggesting, where you make some sort of outline in your own mind. Yeah, like starting off, you know, why is a teacher required? What sort of teacher is required? What sort of quality should they have? What should I have? How am I going to rely on them? And then what do I do when problems come? So if you could sort of make an outline like that and then talk yourself through it, yeah, you get a much, the teachings go deeper into you. It's a sort of, you know, in a way, that's an analytical meditation there. You're analysing the topic and you're coming up, you come up with questions and then you answer the questions.
Okay.
So we've all engaged in some study. We've been doing this for 9 weeks. So we've generated some merit. So through the merit that we've generated, may all beings have happiness. May all beings be free from suffering, and may their suffering ripen upon our ego grasping, our self-cherishing, and our indifference. And never separated from the happiness free of suffering, may all beings abide in equanimity, the equality of all things. Thank you very much, everyone. And we'll see you next time.